It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Sentencing Commission, a bipartisan independent agency, it's considering changing how federal prisoners can request compassionate release. Call in with your questions and comments about inmates with extraordinary circumstances. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Erica Zunkel is a clinical professor of law and associate director of the Federal Criminal Justice Clinic at University of Chicago Law School. She testified before the U.S. Sentencing Commission on proposed changes to compassionate release guidelines. Erica, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks so much for having me.
So compassionate release, essentially early release for incarcerated people in federal prisons when circumstances make it unjustifiable. Can you walk us through what is a typical scenario that leads to compassionate release?
That's a really good question, Kate, and it is changing. What the Sentencing Commission is considering is adding more categories for compassionate release. So I think it's helpful to go back to 1984, which is actually when Congress made some changes to the federal criminal system, both by creating the Sentencing Commission and getting rid of indeterminate sentencing. So that gave judges a lot of discretion over sentences. And what Congress did was say, we're going to have a sentencing commission, they're going to create guidelines that are going to govern judges and how they determine sentences. The Congress also at that same time abolished federal parole, which had been on the books for a long period of time. And that was a way that people were able to go before a parole board and say, you know, I've rehabilitated, I should get my, I should get out early, essentially. Before the end of my sentence. And Congress said, we don't want that anymore. At the same time that they abolished federal parole, they also passed what has become known as compassionate release. It's a sentencing modification mechanism when there are extraordinary and compelling circumstances. So all these things came together at the same time, and Congress said, to the Sentencing Commission, this newly formed agency, you are the ones that decide what are extraordinary and compelling reasons. And Congress also put the Bureau of Prisons in charge of actually bringing these motions. The Bureau of Prisons is the federal jailing bureaucracy in our country. So it was the Sentencing Commission to decide what could be extraordinary and compelling, and then it was up to the Bureau of Prisons to bring these motions. The problem was, since 1984, with the Bureau of Prisons having this authority, they really never brought motions for compassionate release. It was exceedingly rare.
That's what I'm curious about. Does the Bureau of Prisons act on that, grant compassionate release ever, or is this process directly winding through the courts?
So they were not bringing the motions, and Congress became fed up with that. And that was the result of many years of advocacy. Of course, it's a big deal if Congress, given the dysfunction of Congress, if they're saying something is wrong. And they said federal judges should be essentially in charge of compassionate release in the federal system, and people should be able to bypass the Bureau of Prisons, which was not doing its job, and should be able to take their extraordinary and compelling situations to judges directly. So that was the change that was made in 2018 with the First Step Act. At that time, the Sentencing Commission lost a quorum. So they need a quorum to act and make decisions. They didn't have one. So what it left was this uncertain legal landscape. Judges were for the first time getting these motions, but they didn't have the guidance from the Sentencing Commission about what could be an extraordinary and compelling reason after Congress made these changes. So what we've seen over the past 4 years is judges making different decisions about what can be extraordinary and compelling. And that's varied based on the geography where people are bringing their motions. In the Seventh Circuit, which encompasses Wisconsin, Indiana, and Illinois, where I am, compassionate release has been quite restricted. In other places around the country, judges have more discretion to decide extraordinary and compelling reasons. The timing of expanding compassionate release by Congress was really fortuitous, of course, because in this period we've had the COVID pandemic, and that has allowed judges to release people who were at risk of very serious illness or death being in these, you know, COVID breeding grounds and in prison where it was spreading like wildfire. So that was a good thing that the commission is now wanting to codify and put into law through these new compassionate release guidelines.
I want to get into these guideline proposal expansions in just a moment here. But, you know, does the incarcerated person need to hire a lawyer to go through the compassionate release process? Do they need representation for an optimal outcome?
In my view, definitely. Our clinic, we do federal compassionate release work here at the University of Chicago Law School. We have been involved in representing a lot of different people in the past 4 years, some who have medical related reasons for seeking compassionate release, some who have what I call non-medical extraordinary and compelling reasons. And having looked at a lot of motions and a lot of compassionate release grants, I think the quality of representation is incredibly important to the outcome. So in my clinic, we have the ability to hire experts to review people's Bureau of Prisons records, to evaluate and determine if there are, you know, medical, what the scope of their medical issues or mental health issues might be. And then, of course, raise the legal arguments in the most compelling way. So I think attorneys are absolutely essential. Federal defenders and court-appointed attorneys in the federal system have been handling heroically a lot of these motions, and defenders and court-appointed attorneys will be essential for making sure that the broadening of compassionate release is something that can be realized for people who are currently in federal prison behind bars.
So, you know, you've brought up the Bureau of Prisons in this, and the judges in the courts, circuit courts, and the attorneys representing the inmates. What involvement, I'm curious, or sway does the prison warden have in this process? Mm-hmm.
That's a really good question, Kate. So what the First Step Act requires is the Bureau of Prisons hasn't been completely sidelined from this process. The statute requires people to make an initial request for compassionate release to the warden of the facility in which they are imprisoned. That is what we term an exhaustion requirement. So we have to make that request before we can go into court and ask the federal judge to grant the motion. So what this has become more or less is a pro forma request to the warden explaining the extraordinary and compelling reasons for release, describing some release planning, where the person will live, et cetera. And then the warden has it in his or her hands to make an initial determination on that request. And then if they approve it, it would go into various levels of the BOP bureaucracy. The Department of Justice would also be involved. The process is just Byzantine, really, if you even get past that initial approval. And one thing that Congress was concerned about was the length of time that this process was taking within the Bureau of Prisons and trying to expedite that process. So the expectation really is that the warden will deny it. We've received many pro forma denials, and then you can go into court. Again, because the Bureau of Prisons is agreeing to compassionate release in such a small sliver of cases.
University of Chicago clinical law professor Erica Zunkel helping us understand the debate over when people in federal prison should be able to ask for early release. Call in now with your questions, your comments about compassionate release, how you think the system should handle terminal illness or advanced age, other circumstances, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore what the future holds for the federal compassionate release law that allows people in federal prison to be freed early for extraordinary and compelling reasons like terminal illness or old age. Call in with questions or changes you would like to make to the law, what you want the Sentencing Commission to know, 800-642-1234. Erica Zunkel is here, a clinical professor of law at University of Chicago. Erica, I just mentioned terminal illness and old age. What is on the table in terms of expanding the guidelines that the commission is considering?
So there have always been reasons beyond medical reasons in the compassionate release policy statement and guidelines for the Bureau of Prisons and judges. So one that has been on the books for a long time is extraordinary family circumstances. And that has been when a minor child of a person in prison loses a caregiver and has no one else to take care of them. So that is a category, along with the medical categories, that the commission has proposed expanding. So for family circumstances, if there was a spouse or a partner who needed caregiving and couldn't get it from anyone else, the commission's amendments would expand to include that as an extraordinary and compelling reason. The commission has also broadened some of the medical, serious medical reasons for compassionate release. I think the most interesting addition that the commission has made is adding a changes in the law provision. So what we've seen in the last 4 years is that people have come to federal judges and have said, Congress has changed the laws relating to the punishment and sentence I would receive today. And that is an extraordinary and compelling reason in my individualized case. It essentially makes my sentence today unfair and inequitable. And the courts across the country have viewed that particular issue in different ways, and they've come out different ways.
So this is something. Yeah. This is the non-retroactive sentencing piece of it?
Yes. Yeah, so Congress made a number of changes, for example, to drug statutes and mandatory minimum sentences and some firearms enhancements that had the effect of drastically changing what the sentencing structure is today, but Congress did not make those changes retroactive. So what that has meant is that people who were subject to these 924C firearm stacking provisions were subject to, there's one case where it was a 218-year sentence, which today would be drastically lower by hundreds of years. And so the question for judges is that an extraordinary and compelling reason, this change in the law that was not made retroactive when you look at it in an individualized, how it applies in an individual case? And the commission has weighed in and said, sentencing changes or changes in the law that render a sentence inequitable are an extraordinary and compelling reason. So it will be interesting to see what they do with the final amendments on that particular issue.
We're talking about compassionate release from prison with Erica Zunkel, who's Associate Director of the Federal Criminal Justice Clinic at the University of Chicago Law School. Join in at 800-642-1234. Your questions about compassionate release and comments. Erica, say these guidelines are expanded or there are changes, would that affect compassionate release in state prisons? Would there be a ripple effect?
That's a good question, Kate. This applies and would apply to the roughly 160,000 people who are in federal prisons across the country. It would not apply to state prisoners. Across the country, different states have different types of compassionate release programs. Some are only for terminal illness and medical reasons. Some states have other post-conviction sentencing reduction procedures. right now they're around the country called second look mechanisms, which is becoming more common, where at a certain period in someone's sentence, after they've served a certain amount of time, they can go to the judge for a second look and see if a reduction is appropriate. So the states, you know, do things very differently, and this would only apply in federal court. But if there, you know, if it ends up being a good thing, which I very much think expanded compassionate release would be, it may have ripple effects in other places.
What is a possible timeline here for potential changes? Give us a bit of a roadmap.
So the commission is accepting public comment on all of its proposed amendments. So there are proposals for other guidelines as well. They've held hearings the past couple of days. They held a hearing on the compassionate release policy statement in February. They are now going to consider what kinds of changes they may make. And then we expect that they will publish their final amendments in early May. Those then are considered by Congress. And if if Congress does not do anything with those, they would go into effect in November.
We only have a few seconds left. How important are second chances?
They are so important, Kate. We've seen in the federal system, it can be harsh and draconian, and we need a mechanism that can recognize that laws change, people change, and circumstances change. And this is a really important step in the right direction for recognizing more second chances in the federal system.
Erica, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Erica Zunkel is a law professor and associate director of the Federal Criminal Justice Clinic at University of Chicago Law School. She gave testimony to the U.S. Sentencing Commission on proposed changes to compassionate release. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.